So really excited to start a new series of teachings today from the book of John. And so if you have YouVersion, you can click to the book of John. You can open in your Bible to the Gospel of John. We have a great new app here. We have like 250 downloads so far of our app. You can go to the Apple Store or the Google Play Store and download our app. And when you go there, you can just click on sermons, and that's going to take you right to the sermon notes from Sunday, and so you can follow along, and we encourage you to do that.
It's going to be a good sermon,
yeah. Welch's sparkling grape juice. Listen, I am always on the lookout for funny signs, and that's the title of this new series is Signs, as we look at some of the signs of Jesus in the Gospel of John. And so I just wanted to start with some, I think, funny signs this morning. You can bring the lights down just a little bit. That way you can see these signs up on the wall. They're pretty crazy. Sometimes they just don't make any sense, like this sign right here. Do not enter, entrance only. I don't know who came up with that sign. Clearly a little conflicted. This sign is, I think, troubling in a different sense. And you know, we all know Wendy's, and Dave passed away. In memory of Dave, we will miss you. Now hiring. So Dave is missed, but not that much, because you know they're hiring somebody to replace Dave. This one, I've got older parents, so this one kind of bothered me a little bit. Now, I know it, right? Oh, I heard somebody say, I feel like this is maybe some other place, like not America, because I've never seen that sign before. But, yeah. So, here's this one for you science nerds, because we have a lot of students from Michigan State University here. Free Wi-Fi, and this is what you need to figure out the password. The function of X equals something plus sigma something cosine something B sine something. Now, here's what really is kind of freaky about this one is there are people, and this is you, this is who you are, church. This is who you are. You need to know. There are people right now, and I'm going slow because they're furiously scribbling down this equation because they genuinely want to figure this out. We have some people just like that here. We actually have free Wi-Fi because there's no way in the world I could figure out how to work that. Here's the last one, though, and I don't get this one. This is actually sort of a juxtaposition, right? That, you know, they just kind of go together, but not really. Jesus, beefy, cheesy, glory, glory, yeah. Signs, crazy signs. We're starting this new series of sermons called Signs, and I want you to know, if you're not yet a Jesus follower, this series is going to be great for you. If you're not yet a Christian, you're going to love this series, because John is writing to a group of people who, you know, maybe have some of the same thoughts or questions or issues that you have. John is writing to a group of people who lived in the first century, and they weren't really sure what to make of Jesus. Was Jesus a man? Was Jesus God? Was he some of both? Was he something in between? So John is writing to this group of people who maybe have some of the same questions that you have. So if you're not yet a follower of Jesus, I'm so glad you're here, and I hope you stick around for this entire series, because we're going to look at some of the signs that point to who Jesus is. Now, if you're already a follower of Jesus, a lot of these teachings, they're going to seem familiar to you, because what we're looking at are some of the events in Jesus' life that some of the other biographers call miracles. John calls them signs. But for you, they may seem familiar. You're going to think, you know what, I've heard that story before. But hopefully, over the course of the next 5 weeks, you're going to learn something new about these familiar events in Jesus' life. And as we lead up to Easter, this whole series is going to culminate on Easter Sunday, believe it or not, on April 4th, just a few weeks away. Easter is that close. As this series leads up to Easter Sunday, what I want you to know is this would be a great series to bring someone to that maybe is far from God, or maybe it's your unsaved friend, or your person at the office who used to go to church but maybe doesn't go to church anymore. This would be a great series for you to bring that person to reintroduce them, or introduce them maybe to the first time, to the person of Jesus, because this series is all about
Who is Jesus? We want to understand the identity of Jesus, and John helps us do that. So just a little bit of background on John as we kind of get started. John is one of four biographers who wrote about Jesus' life. There are four biographies in what we call our New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. John writes one of two eyewitness accounts. Matthew was an eyewitness, John was an eyewitness. Mark got most of his information, we think, from Peter's sermons. And so Mark traveled with Peter, who was also an eyewitness to Jesus' life. And most of the book of Mark, we think, comes from Peter's sermons, and Mark wrote down these stories about Jesus. Luke got most of his information, we think, from the Apostle Paul as he prepared a legal document to support the Apostle Paul when he was on trial in Rome. Now, but John and Matthew both have these eyewitness accounts. And John is the latest of the four biographies. He writes last. Matthew, Mark, Luke, they all write before John. John, who we think lived to be the oldest of any of Jesus' disciples, his 12 initial followers, we believe that John writes later than any of these other biographers, probably somewhere between 60 and 70 AD. And so John, he's writing to a group of people who are just confused about who Jesus is. Some of them, see, there was this thinking in the first century that said physical things and spiritual things are in two completely different realms, and they cannot mix. They never mix. There's never an overlap between the physical and the spiritual. It was sort of a dualistic thinking process, that there are spiritual things and there are physical things, but they're two entirely separate. And so Jesus comes along, and Jesus claims to be both physical, he's man, he's incarnate. I mean, he was born of the Virgin Mary, right? He lived a life. He was a man. He died on a cross. And the Bible tells us everything that you and I experience, he has experienced. So Jesus comes along. He claims to be a man. At the same time, he claims to be God. And so how is it possible, many people in this first century with this kind of dualistic thinking, they're asking, how is it possible that a person can be both man and God? It blows their mind. They cannot comprehend it. And so there were a couple of misunderstandings that arose in the first century about Jesus. Some believed that he was fully man, that he was absolutely a man, right? He was born, he lived, he died, but they couldn't accept the fact that he was God in the flesh. They couldn't accept the fact that he, in fact, was the incarnation of God walking among us. Alternatively, there were a group of people who believed that Jesus was fully God, that he was divine, that he was God come to earth. But because they believed that the physical and the spiritual could not ever connect or couldn't mix, they believed that his body was actually sort of an apparition, that it was not real. I mean, it appeared to be real, but he wasn't actually flesh, okay? He was this spiritual being that only looked like he was a fleshly being. And so this heresy or this misunderstanding arose in the first century called Docetism, where they believed that Jesus was God, but he wasn't really a person. He wasn't really a man. And so John, we think, is writing to correct these misunderstandings about Jesus. John is writing to first century believers to say to them, look, you need to understand Jesus is God and Jesus is man. He's fully God, he's fully human, and because of that, he's the only one. He is unique in all of human history to be both God and man. And so John's writing to help us understand that. And so John is very selective in what he tells us about Jesus. He only selects certain events of Jesus' life. Now, the other three biographers, they tell us all sorts of stories about Jesus, stories of healing and stories of miraculous provision. And they, in fact, call all of these events or these episodes in Jesus' life, they call them miracles. John, on the other hand, he does not call these events that he selects miracles. Instead, he calls them signs. The word for miracle, the ancient Greek word that we translate miracle, really has to do with Jesus' power, right? And his authority. It has to do with the power that Jesus had to do the supernatural. But John calls these signs, and that word sign doesn't deal so much with Jesus' power. Instead, it reveals Jesus' identity. So a miracle is all about power. A sign is all about revelation. And so John doesn't even use that Greek word for miracle. Instead, he uses the Greek word for sign. And in the book of John, he selects seven signs in chapters 1 through 11. He selects seven signs that he tells his readers, and by extension us, that he tells us about so that we can better understand who Jesus is. And so you think of it like this. They're like these concentric circles in the book of John. And John tells us a little bit about Jesus in chapter 2, so we begin to understand his identity. He tells us a little bit more about Jesus in chapter 4, and so we understand more of Jesus' identity. And then he reveals more in chapter 5 and in the subsequent chapters, right up to chapter 11, until we fully understand, oh, okay, this is who Jesus is. He is God, he is man. John helps us understand this at the end of his gospel, at the end of his biography in chapter 20, verse 30. Here's what John has to say. Sort of sums up the whole book. It's a summary statement of his biography of Jesus. He says, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. So John makes it clear. We don't have all the signs of Jesus. We don't have all the stories of Jesus. We do have some of them. He says some of them we have in this book. Some of them are not recorded. Many of them, he says, are not recorded in this book. Verse 31, but here's why. Here's why he records these signs. John says, but these signs are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, that is the anointed one, the one sent from heaven for you and me, that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. That's what John wants from his listeners. That's what God wants for us. That's what I want for you. I want, as over the next 5 weeks, as we look at five of these seven signs, over the next 5 weeks, my hope is that you will understand more of who Jesus is, that God will reveal Jesus' identity to you, and that so by believing who Jesus is, you will have life in his name. Now, in each one of these signs, there's something interesting taking place. In each one of these signs, there are two sort of forces at work. There are two things taking place. In each one of these signs, there is a practical solution to a problem. Jesus comes along, there's a problem here, he fixes it. In each one of these signs, there's a practical solution, but in each one of these signs, there is also a spiritual revelation. See, Jesus fixes something practical, but he also reveals something more about himself so that we can better understand who he is. And the first of these signs we find in John chapter 2. It's a story that you hear about every time you go to a wedding. So John chapter 2, let's start in verse 1. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. Right off the bat, you know what I love about this? I love it that Jesus is at a wedding. So much of the time, an artist depicts Jesus this way. And in fact, I was just looking at one of the Jesus movies this week, and Jesus is this like serious, sober, somber individual, you know. And the filmmaker just portrayed Jesus as this sort of, I don't know, sort of depressed, sort of buzzkill character, you know. And I love that John points out right at the beginning, the very first sign of Jesus takes place at a wedding. Jesus is celebrating with his friends. Now, Cana is about 75 miles north of Jerusalem. And Cana is actually Nathanael's hometown. Nathanael is one of Jesus' first 12 disciples, or his first 12 followers. And so Nathanael's from Cana. And so who knows? It would seem likely that Nathanael knew the bride and the groom. Maybe he was even one of the groom's men. We don't know. But Cana's also just about 4 or 5 miles north of Nazareth, the town where Jesus grew up. And so it seems likely that in that small sort of geographical space, that Jesus also knew the bride and groom. Certainly his mother did, as we'll learn more about her and her involvement in this event in just a little bit. And so here's this wedding feast, and Jesus and his disciples are there, and the bride and the groom and the family, they're familiar to him. And John points out that it was on the third day, so that means it's a Tuesday when this is happening. It's a Tuesday. Here's what we know about ancient weddings. Ancient weddings began, they took place either on a Wednesday or a Thursday. If the bride was a virgin, if she's being married for the first time, the wedding took place on a Wednesday. If the bride was a widow, if she'd been previously married, the wedding took place on a Thursday. That's how they did it in ancient Israel. And so now it is a Tuesday. Well, you're thinking, well, you know, the wedding took place on a Wednesday, now it's a Tuesday, how's that possible? Well, in Jesus' day, weddings lasted a long time. Have you ever been to a wedding that just lasted a really long time? I was in a wedding once with my buddy Fred Lab, and I swear, the people who rent the tuxedo shoes, who rent the shoes, they're like in league with the podiatrists. They got like a kickback or something going on, you know? And I'm standing up there, and my dogs are screaming. And I'm thinking, come on, preacher, just get this wedding over with so I can change into my tennis shoes, right? Well, this wedding doesn't last an hour or 2 hours. This wedding, like all weddings in Jesus' day, was a feast that lasted multiple days, in many instances, a week. So the wedding takes place on a Wednesday. It is now the following Tuesday. Right? It's 6 days later, and Jesus is there, his mother's there, his disciples, his followers are there. Look what happens in verse 3. Verse 3, when the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, they have no more wine. Well, that sort of makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, the wedding was on Wednesday, they've feasted now for a whole week, and now it's Tuesday, and finally the wine runs out. What's the big deal? Well, it's a huge deal. Maybe not so much in our culture, right? It's difficult for us to kind of wrap our minds around why this is such a big deal. But in the ancient Near East, where this is taking place, there was this huge element of, I guess we'd call it reciprocity, right? Tit for tat. You scratch my back, I scratch yours. And so here's how it worked. When you held a wedding, you were responsible not just to marry off your daughter and your future son-in-law. You were responsible to sort of pay back all of those who had invited you to their family weddings over the years. And quite literally, if you failed in your obligation to throw a good wedding, to throw an adequate wedding, if you brought a crummy wedding gift, quite literally now, not making this up, if you brought a crummy wedding gift, or if the food and drink runs out before it should, you quite literally can and often would be sued by the guests. Right? Can you imagine? You run out of those little mints and those Spanish peanuts at the table, right? Next thing you know, you're getting a call from Sam Bernstein. Bam, right? You quite literally could be sued. And so this is a calamity. This is a calamity for the bride and the groom. They have run out of wine. It's not just a matter of them being bad hosts. It's not just a matter of them being impolite. No, this is a train wreck for them financially, in terms of embarrassment. It's a train wreck for everyone involved. And so John points out this practical problem. Hey, the wine is gone, and now Jesus' mother enters the scene. And it becomes quite clear that she's not just a guest at the wedding. She's somehow connected to the wedding party. Because Jesus' mother says to him, hey, Jesus, They have no more wine. It's a practical problem. It's a practical problem, but it also has some spiritual significance. You see, John writes about this, number one, to tell us that Jesus cares about our practical problems. When, you know, we've run out of wine and we're embarrassed and we're humiliated, Jesus cares about that. But there's spiritual significance too, because John is basically saying, hey, the old way of doing things, the old system of the law and the temple worship and all of that, it's essentially, John is saying, bankrupt. You can write across the old way of connecting with God, they have no more wine. That's why John gives us this sign. That's why he shares this story with us. And so Jesus' mother comes to him and says, hey, Jesus, they have no more wine. Look at what Jesus says in verse 4, because to me it seems kind of harsh. He says, woman, now, if I say that to my mom, she goes, slap my face off, right? Woman, why do you involve me? Jesus replied, my hour has not yet come. Now, to our thinking, this seems rude, right? Jesus is saying, woman. Now, in the first century, in this context, Jesus is not being rude. In fact, Jesus uses the same word when he's hanging from the cross to refer to his mother. It is a term of respect, actually a term of endeared respect. So he's showing her respect, but what he's also doing is he is demonstrating to her our relationship is about to change. For all of these years, I've called you mother, and you've called me son. But now you're coming to me with this problem, and on the cusp of my ministry beginning here to fulfill what God has called me to do, now our relationship is changing. And so he doesn't call her mother anymore. He gives her this respectful term. He says, woman, why do you involve me? My hour has not yet come. Over and over, this is a theme we see in John, that Jesus talks about the hour or my hour. He knows this hour that he's referring to is the time of his sacrifice and resurrection. That's the hour that Jesus is constantly referring to in John. He's basically saying, hey, it's not yet time for me to lay down my life on the cross. It's not yet time. And Mary, like good Jewish mothers everywhere, ignores him. He says, my hour is not yet come. And she says, you guys, just do whatever he tells you to do. You servants, just do whatever he tells you. This is where it gets really good. This is where we begin to really understand the spiritual significance of this event and why John chooses this as the first sign that points to Jesus. Verse 6. Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. These jars are significant. Each family would have had probably only one. What that means is that for this event, the groom's family has gone around to the neighbors and to the relatives, and they've borrowed their ceremonial washing jars. And so they have 6 of these holding 20 to 30 gallons, somewhere between 120 and 180 gallons. They're made out of stone, and this is significant. The ancient Jews had several ways that you could hold a liquid. You could hold a liquid in a wine skin, a skin made from an animal. You could hold a liquid in a clay pot, or you could hold a liquid in a stone jar. Why a stone jar? Well, both a wine skin and clay could become ceremonially unclean. In the ancient Jewish tradition, in the way that they worshiped, those pots could become unclean. And if they're unclean, they had to be discarded. And so you would never use a clay pot or a wineskin to hold ceremonial water for washing because they could become unclean and contaminated. You would instead use a jar that was cut or carved from stone. This is significant. We'll explain why in just a minute. But so here are these 6 stone jars. I wanted to buy one just to have here for you to look at today, right? But a Pier 1 Trading, the biggest one I could find was only 15 gallons and it was super expensive. But we're talking big jars, 20 to 30 gallons. made out of stone, six of them. Jesus said to the servants, verse 7, Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. So they filled them to the brim, filled them right up. Then he told them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. They did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you've saved the best until now. Here's what's going on. I mean, on the face of it, right? Jesus is saving this couple from embarrassment. This couple who's run out of wine and now they're embarrassed among their friends and their relatives, their neighbors. They're even open to some, you know, pecuniary damages. They can be sued because they've run out of wine. Jesus is fixing a practical problem. He provides them with, you know, 120, maybe 180 gallons of wine, plenty of wine to finish the party. Jesus fixes that problem, but there's something far more significant here, and that's why John chooses this sign to share with us. Picture yourself at this wedding. You come to this wedding in the first century, they're in Cana, and when you arrive, a servant takes purification water and washes your hands and your feet so that you are ritually pure among all of your peers and before God. You are pure. You stand purified before God. That's the purpose of this purification water that is there at the entrance to this home. Now, this water that was used for purifying has instead been replaced with wine. And so spiritually what is going on here is Jesus is saying the old way of being made right with God, that is being purified by this symbolic water, no longer is in effect. Jesus is saying essentially, you don't need to do that anymore because Jesus says, I am your purification. I am all you need to stand in good stead before the Lord. You no longer need all of those rituals. You no longer need, you know, every time you mess up, you can't keep the law. You're trying to do the right things, trying to obey the Ten Commandments, but, you know, you covet your neighbor's donkey and all of a sudden you got to go to the temple and, sacrifice an animal, right? Jesus says, no longer do you need to do that because the old way of doing things is past. Jesus says, I am the new way of doing things. I am your purification. That's why John shares this with us. John wants us to understand that Jesus is the new way of connecting with God, and Jesus is better than anything that has come before. Did you know you can buy wine in a box? Yeah, I learned that this week. I thought, I'm gonna go to Meijer, and I'm gonna get a really expensive bottle of wine, and I'm gonna get a really cheap bottle of wine, and that's why I can tell people, Jesus is the better wine, right? And then I got wine in a box. It's like this big, giant juice box for adults, right? I turned it around. I was looking for the big straw on the back. You know, you peel the straw off and stab it in the spigot. And wine in a box. I didn't even know they had that. And then I thought, there's the wine in a box, which is like 2 for $10 or something, right? And then there's like this, they had like a $60 bottle of Chateau. And I thought, that's got to be expensive. You can't even pronounce it. Instead, I bought Welch's Sparkling Red Grape Juice Cocktail. Right? No alcohol. Jesus is not wine in a box. Here's the thing. That's what some of you have been settling for. You've been settling for that wine in a box in your life. You've been trying to connect with God by keeping all the rules, and it just doesn't seem to work. Or you've been trying to connect with, you know what, if I just go to church, I can connect with God. That's all I got to do. So I'm there on Sunday from 10 to 10:15, or, you know, this morning because it was time change. If I'm there on Sunday from like 10:30 to 11, right? That's all I need to do just to connect with. No, Jesus says, that's the old wine. That's the wine in a box. That's yuck. Jesus says the way to connect with the Father is through me. And so John tells us that this wine, this you know, now we have 180 gallons of wine in these stone jars, in these purification jars that represents Jesus. He says it's better than everything that came before. Everything that happens before Jesus is inferior. Everything that happens after Jesus is superior because Jesus is better. So whatever you've been doing in your life before Jesus, man, that's inferior. Whatever you've been doing to try and connect with God is before him, before Jesus, is inferior. Whatever you've been doing to try and live the right way before Jesus is inferior. And Jesus says, if you really want to connect with God, if you really want the good stuff, he says, just come to me, because he says, I am better. Jesus is better. John finishes out this whole section in verse 11. Here's what John says. What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. The old way that you and I try to do things, the pre-Jesus way, man, it is lame. It doesn't work. Jesus is better. And I get it. I get that that's sort of counterintuitive for us. I mean, when we think about wine, and I don't know a lot about wine. I'm not a sommelier, and I just don't know about that stuff. But I do know that, when you look at the label, if it says 2002, that means that the wine is better than if the label says Tuesday, right? In other words, in our culture, the old wine, typically, the old wine is better than the new wine. That's just kind of how we think, right? But Jesus is so counterintuitive here. Jesus goes against what many of us would think. Jesus says, no, the old wine isn't better. He says the new wine is better. And guess what? Jesus says, I am the new wine. And so what Jesus wants for you today is to experience him. Jesus wants for you to stop trying to connect with God by keeping the rules. Stop trying to connect with God by, just making apologies every time you mess up. I mean, of course we need to repent, but what Jesus is saying is, I want you to connect with God through me. Maybe for you, the old way you've been doing it just isn't working anymore, and you're just constantly filled with guilt, and you're constantly racked with this idea that you're just not good enough. You know what? You're not good enough on your own. You're only good enough through Jesus. And so this morning, what I would say to you as you come and share in this meal and eat this bread and drink this juice, as you remember Jesus' death and burial and resurrection, what I believe the Father would say to you is, if you follow my Son, we're good. If you love my Jesus, if Jesus is the new wine in your life, the Father would say to you, I affirm you, I love you, you are deeply loved, you are totally accepted, you are fully forgiven, and you are complete in me. Because Jesus is better. So here's what we're going to do. Wally's going to lead us in a couple of songs. We're going to sing, and you're going to have the opportunity to come to one of these tables, three in the front and three in the back, and to just share in this meal, to eat bread that reminds us that Jesus died on the cross, and to drink to drink this juice that reminds us that his blood purchases our forgiveness, that it's through his blood that we're made pure, that we're cleansed. And so you can, we're going to stand and we're going to sing in just a moment. You can come at the beginning, you can come at the middle, you can come at the end. You can come by yourself, come with your family, come with your small group. But as you eat this bread and as you drink this juice, what I want you to remember today is Jesus is better. It is through him that we gain access to the Father. Not through ourselves, not through our own good work, only through Jesus. I want to pray for you this morning. Lord, too much of our lives, we've believed that it's Jesus plus. The way we get to you is through Jesus plus keeping all the rules. Through Jesus plus perfect attendance in church. Through Jesus plus serving in Sunday school or serving in a ministry. We affirm that those things are important, but we recognize, Father, that it's not through those things that we gain access to you. It's through your son, Jesus. That Jesus is better. He's better than our own efforts at trying to connect with you. He's better at our own efforts at trying to be made right or holy or pure by keeping rules or bringing you sacrifices. That Jesus is better. That he is better than all of our efforts. That he is better than the old wine of the old covenant. That Jesus is better. And so this morning we thank you for your son. We ask, Father, that this week when we begin to feel stressed or guilty, when we begin to think that we're not enough, that you would remind us that Jesus is enough. And that because of him, we can come to you. So as we celebrate this meal, Lord, eating bread, drinking juice, remind us that Jesus is enough. It's in his name we pray. As you come this morning and receive these gifts, you'll see some people scattered throughout the room wearing blue lanyards. They're either elders in our church or part of our prayer team. You know, if you want to know how to better connect with Jesus today, if you want to know how to follow him the way Derek and Cheryl have committed to following him today, please talk to one of us in one of these blue lanyards. And we'll tell you how Jesus is better. Now let's stand and let's sing and come and receive the gift.